Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, I'm Jahan Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
Subject is
fate. And
so after the marshmallow story, I was thinking, you know how people, when they hear a thing like that, that your child will be successful through life if it
you can know it at age 4.
Right. This is actually how people behave. They try to figure out in their children, well, where are the deficits? Where are the advantages? How can we
as early as possible?
And, yes, and they project out from the 4-year-old straight to college.
Yeah.
And there are some people in this world who find this obnoxious. And one of them is Malcolm Gladwell, who grew up in Toronto.
Okay, just pull it to your mouth there.
It's Canada, so they don't do any of this sort of thing. He's the author of Outliers. And at the 92nd Street Y, he told me how much he hates gifted and talented programs.
It's ridiculous. Why do you decide? So a gifted program says that we identify a child and call that child gifted because of their performance at the age of whatever, 9 or 10 or 11 years old. Why do we care particularly how well a child performs at 9 or 10 or 11 years old? They're 9 or 10 or 11. They're a good 25 years from making any kind of substantial contribution to the world. Why don't we wait? What's the hurry? And also, how do you know? So, like, you know, so one child learns to read at 4. One child learns to read at 2.5, right? So what? Why does it matter? Are the things that are being read between 2.5 and 4 of such incalculable...
It's the normal parent's response to, oh, if he's reading at 2.5, think of the things he'll do, and it's just an extrapolation.
I know, but like, reading is reading. Once you can read, we're done. I mean, it's not like there's an infinite scale, and that so-and-so reads better and better and better, and we can say today of Gladwell that he reads so much better than Krulwich, and that this is like what separates the two of us. It's reading. I mean, like...
Well, but now the effect, for example, on... Like, you use the phrase the Matthew effect. What is that?
Matthew effect is a phrase coined by Robert K. Merton, the great genius sociologist of Columbia. He's a guy who says, in the verse in Matthew, which says that to him who has much more will be given. And he uses this to describe the Matthew effect, which is this notion that a small initial advantage difference in the performance of any two people will inevitably grow because the person who's a little bit ahead will get so many more advantages that they will end up being far ahead. So a good example, there's all kinds of great Matthew effects. So if you're a young boy born in October, November, or December, who has designs on being a professional soccer or hockey player, the deck is stacked against you. There's not much you can do. You should probably give up.
but there's a
wait, why exactly?
This. Well, it's really an accident of birth thing. The month you were born in, Malcolm thinks, might make a huge, huge difference in your life. Here's his way of describing this. I'm going to read here a passage from his book, Outliers.
On page 23 of your book, you do a play-by-play.
Kind of a clever way to do this.
Uh-huh. We're at the Memorial Cup Hockey Championship. I want to read what you wrote. March 11th starts around one side of the Tigers' net, leaving the puck for his teammate January 4th. He passes it to January 22, flips it back to March 12th, who shoots point-blank at the Tigers' goalie. April 27th, blocks the shot, rebounded by Vancouver's March 6th. He shoots Medicine Hat defenseman February 9th and February 14th dive to block the puck. January 10th looks on helplessly. March 6th scores. Question is, why did you choose this peculiar kind of nomenclature?
Because I wanted to make this point that an extraordinary number of hockey players are born in the first 3 or 4 months of the year.
17 of the 25 players on the Medicine Hat team were born in those first 3 months.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Because the eligibility cutoff date for age class hockey in Canada, in the world, is January 1st. And we start recruiting all-star squads in hockey in Canada when kids are 9 and 10 years old. But, of course, when you're 9 years old, the best one is the oldest one, right? So all you do is you choose the kids who are born closest to the cutoff date, and then you give them special coaching and put them on all-star squads until 9 and extra games and extra practice until 8 and 9 years later they really are the best. And, by the way, we see exactly the same effects in school systems. Right, the relatively youngest kids in the class underperform the relatively oldest kids, and that underperformance lasts into the college years. The kid born the last 3 months of the youngest 3 months of their age cohort in school are something like, I forget the exact number, 9 or 10% less likely to go to college than those born in the three oldest months.
And but you know, Chad, I agree that, you know, when you're born matters, of course.
Yeah.
But I kept saying to him, well, what about natural talent? What about if you really were a great hockey player?
Just popped out with it.
And then he said, well, it's really practice, ability plus practice, emphasis on practice. I said, no. What about the idea of just being a genius? He has this problem.
You were being accused of being a genius denier.
Yes.
Are you a genius denier, or are you simply a genius disliker?
There's clearly this thing called talent, right?
Right.
And it's the magic dust, right, that gets sprinkled onto persistence that turns a lot of hard work into something great. And the question is, how large a role does it play, and what does it consist of? I mean, in a piece I wrote years ago for The New Yorker, I remember writing about Wayne Gretzky and reading a biography of Wayne Gretzky, and
This is a great hockey player.
Great hockey player. Greatest hockey player of all time. And as a kid, when he's 2 years old, his parents would sit him in front of the television, and he would watch hockey games on Saturday nights. And when the game ended, he would burst into tears, right? And it was this little glimpse into his future greatness, because here he was at two, and he loved this thing. He couldn't even play hockey. He's two. I mean, he can barely walk. But he already has understood he loves this thing so much that for it to end is an unconscionable burden, right? And it's like the world is ending, and he's disconsolate. So what is Wayne Gretzky's talent? Well, part of it is his extraordinary, vision, his coordination, his whatever is this. But a lot of it is this guy loves this game so much that he would do nothing but do it and think about it and engage it and do all those things. Now, is this magic dust called talent, is that all it is? Maybe. Why are people so hostile to the notion that what genius is an extraordinary love for a particular thing? Why is the love... We hear the ability definition of genius, the rare ability definition, and we think, oh, that's so plausible. Totally, that's what it is. But then we hear the extraordinary love definition of genius, and we say, he's a genius denier. Why? Why are we so hostile to the notion that what separates the genius from the rest of us is the genius loves what he or she does more than we do? But we have no problem at all that what separates the genius is that they have
It misses the point. I mean, there are people like Paul McCartney.
Are you hostile to the notion of love, Robert? Is that what that is?
I just want to make an obvious point here that, Harry Smith No, that's a real person. Harry X could love writing songs, but Paul McCartney
even
could
the
love...
way you say love though is so. Really, have you thought about this?
Okay, come on, I'll do other different. Your Harry X could love, love.
That's better.
Writing songs. Uh-huh. He loves writing songs so much that he can't stop, but for lunch and dinner, and sometimes not even those. But next door is Richard Rodgers, little Richard, Ricky Rodgers. Mm-hmm. He loves writing songs too. But for some reason, Harry writes and loves writing. Ricky writes and loves writing. And Harry writes an unmemorable song called The Babbling Brook Goes To and Flow. And Richard writes Some Enchanted Evening.
Well, no. So you're...
So there's a difference there.
No, well, but hold on.
The love doesn't get you...
No. The love, but the love does. So think about this. Love is not the complete explanation. Love is the way in. Because Wayne Gretzky loves hockey so much, he thinks about it all the time and does more than that. He engages the sport in a way that no one else has ever engaged it. So there's this wonderful, when I was writing about Gretzky, there's this thing that he famously did once where he scored a goal from behind the net and he flips the puck over the net, like, and it kind of does a little thing and goes in. The reason no one had ever done that before was not just that no one could do it, lots of people could do it, it had never occurred to anyone else before, right? No one had engaged the sport on that level. So why is Gretzky engaging in that way? Why is he thinking about it that deeply and creatively? Because he can't get hockey out of his head, right? Mm. Whenever I encounter someone like that, I cannot get past that sense they give off that they have found their calling, that they are actively in love, in almost a romantic way with this thing that they do.
No, you're right?
Absent that, you can't be a genius. I'm sorry, you can't. Are you convinced yet? Are you still holding out for some chilly, abstract, you know, Nietzschean notion of...
No, I'm going to pull back for a minute here and try another tack altogether.
Well, let me just to
I got a little shy there at the
moment. Yeah, but to give you credit, my Nietzschean co-host.
Thank you.
You know, there are people who try, love what they're trying to do deeply, and yet fail. Over and over.
But that's because they don't have the talent. That's what I was arguing. They don't have the talent to do it.
No, so but I'm not thinking of a whole other category of being who just seem doomed.
To failure?
Endless failure.
Like?
Well, Walters, you wanted to just play this from the beginning?
Yeah. Just one second here.
This is our producer, Pat Walters.
You live in Arkansas, is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
I don't think you have roadrunners down there, do you?
No, they're roadrunners. I think they've maybe gotten into the far western part of the state.
You know what that is, Chad?
I hate that freaking bird.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a roadrunner. And who is this dude?
This is Mike Barrier.
I'm the author of a book called Hollywood Cartoons, American Animation in Its Golden Age.
He's basically the guy you call if you have like a big, profound question about Looney Tunes.
Looney Tunes.
Yeah. A few months ago, Lulu and I started wondering, like...
Lulu Miller, our former producer.
Why is Roadrunner so good? Because I'm at least in the camp.
That's your question?
Yeah. But before we get to the answer, I just want to give you a little background on the cartoon.
All right. Go for it.
It's 1949, and you're at the movies with your wife. You go in and you take a seat, and when the movie starts, one of the very first things you see is a cartoon. And in the 40s and 50s, most of these cartoons were...
Chase cartoons, Tom and Jerry being the prime example.
Problem was, this chase thing was a formula. It was rigid, and it got a lot of cartoonists kind of bored.
Yeah.
So one day, this kind of famous cartoonist named Chuck Jones, sitting around with his buddy Mike Maltese.
Just talking about what oddball combinations of characters that could be chasing each other. I think Maltese thought about having an aardvark chasing a gnu or something like that.
What's
something
a gnu? I don't even know what a gnu is. But just to cut to the chase, eventually they decided, let's make a cartoon about...
A coyote chasing a roadrunner.
And when this cartoon came out, it was huge. It was a hit.
What does it mean for a cartoon to be a hit?
Like in those days, cartoons usually only ran one time.
Huh.
But this one was different.
6 months after it came out, they started making another one.
Which was almost completely unheard of. Which brings us back to Lulu's question.
Why is Roadrunner so good? Because I'm at least in the camp that it's way better than Tom and Jerry.
And Mike says it's actually all about
the coyote. He's an extraordinarily human animal.
And not just like in the facial expressions that he made and the ways that he looked at the camera a lot.
Yeah.
But actually, it kind of was about the predicaments that he found himself in.
Meaning?
Take, for example, this one really famous cartoon. Like always, Coyote has got a plan. He has made a painting of the road.
Showing the road continuing over a chasm.
Like he's put this painting right at the edge of the cliff.
The idea being the Roadrunner would run through the painting, gravity would take hold of him, and he would plunge into the chasm.
Roadrunner comes flying down the highway, and he gets to the painting. But he doesn't fall.
Instead, the Roadrunner runs into the painting as if it were the road were actually continuing. But then when the coyote tries to follow the Roadrunner into the painting, he runs through the painting and falls.
And he looks up at the camera and he shrugs and he's like, why did the bird get to run into the painting and not me?
Gravity isn't this uniform, indifferent force. Mm. It's a malignant force that actually that comes in and out of play according to how inconvenient it can be for the coyote.
But that's interesting. The Roadrunner isn't his real opponent at all. It's the universe.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, he's chasing the Roadrunner, but the universe is his opponent. Absolutely.
And that's kind of what makes the coyote seem so human. He's in that situation that all of us feel like we're in sometimes. Like the very laws of physics are against us.
Yeah, yeah, it's almost a primitive way of thinking, but you know, but I think all of us lapse into this, you know, that how can this happen?
Right,
you know,
the universe is out to get me.
Like. Yeah, yeah, you can't be human and not feel that way.
On the other hand, even though the universe is screwing you, at least it's noticing you.
It's kind of flattering in a way.
It's totally flattering, yeah. And this, Mike says, is why the cartoon works. Like on the one hand, it confirms our paranoias, and on the other, it kind of plays to our vanity.
Flattering. Is that really? I mean, when you said flattering a second ago, is that really what it is?
You don't see it that way?
I don't know. I've never liked this cartoon because he never wins. It's like, what's more flattering, to live in a world that actively screws you at every turn or one that just doesn't care about you? Like a Nietzschean void.
I don't really know. That's kind of tough.
I go with the void.
No!
What do you mean
totally
no?
Totally ignored by the universe?
Yes!
That's the worst.
As opposed to being actively screwed by the universe? Yeah, sure, ignore me.
You don't know. What you don't know. Let me tell you the story. I went to ABC News and I did a story that went very well. And then the next week I did a story which went very badly. And the head of the place, Rune Arledge, called me into his office. And this was Rune Arledge, a legend in broadcasting. And then he put his face right in front of my face, his nose almost touching my nose, and said to me, I hated this, I hated that, what's wrong with you? And instead of being sad and upset, inside my head, like Wile E. Coyote himself, I thought, wow, he knows my name. He watched my story.
But if Rune Arledge had said that to you every single day.
Well, he didn't do it every single day.
I know, but in cartoon form, that's essentially what's happening here.
Yes, but
the
cartoon
is yelling at
but,
him.
But the reason
saying,
I like Wile E. Coyote
no,
is
no.
because I admire the guy. He has no evidence at all that anything good will ever happen to him, and yet he wakes up every day with hope.
Meep, meep. Hope schmope. He's just a masochist.
thank you, Pat and Lulu. Thank you to Pat and Lulu.
See ya. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in a digital age. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the George Lucas Educational Foundation, providing schools at work. Strategies for 21st century success. Learn more at edutopia.org.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.